welcome to the XCast X-Files Podwatch. This is episode 51, and we are talking today the episodes Unusual Suspects and Detour. I am your host, Tony Black, and joining me is my co-host for this Podwatch double bill, Mr. Darren Mooney. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm okay. A little secret, guys, right? This is the first one outside of the very first Podwatch that I am recording. Now, you will have heard me on previous episodes before this, but this is the first one I'm recording, so this is quite exciting for me, really. This is my first proper go at doing the Podwatch, Darren.
Shh, Tony, you're ruining the magic. Lucian, this is all live.
Yeah,
this is recorded.
Yeah, of course.
Anytime you're listening to this, this is we're recording. We're in a little booth recording this live.
Yeah, I'm ruining it, aren't I?
It's all horribly shattered. No, it's great, actually. It's really good. I've done a couple of these already, out of sequence and into sequence and stuff like that. They're great fun, actually. They really, really are. And I'm kind of thrilled that I get to be here for your first time around.
Oh, thank you very much. Very nice of you. Very nice of you. You've already hosted and been a guest on some fantastic ones beforehand. So, yeah, we're roughly around halfway through the Podwatch now. There and abouts. There are, overall around 100 and I think it's 107 episodes. So we're almost at the halfway point now. So well done, guys. If you've been listening for the last 50 days, you've been doing very, very well and keeping up on this Podwatch. we'll kick this one off by talking about the first one today, which is Unusual Suspects. So yeah, this is the second episode of... the third episode, I should say, of the fifth season. And this is a bit of an unusual one, Darren, isn't it? Quite, appropriately.
Appropriately, given the title.
Given the title. Because it's just a complete flashback episode. And it's the kind of the Lone Gunman origin, isn't it?
It is. It's sort of like a stealth pilot for the Lone Gunman show. I mean, I'm fairly sure everybody listening to this knows the story behind it, which is basically Dave Duchovny and Gillian Anderson were off doing the movie and they need to do reshoots. And so at the start of the production season, the writers need a script that had no Gillian Anderson and was very light on David Duchovny. And so they turned to Vince Gilligan and said, well, what can you do? And he said, okay, well, how about we take the Lone Gunman, basically, and do an episode based entirely around them? And the result is absolutely fascinating. Like, I would argue, like, the fifth season of The X-Files is really great. It's not as great as, say, the third season, and I have a very soft spot for the eighth season. But the fifth season of The X-Files is just a really great piece of television. And, like, it's episodes like this. I don't think many people, when they're ranking the fifth season, rank Unusual Suspects particularly high, because I think even if you're talking about, say, Vince Gilligan's episodes, the fifth season episode everyone wants to talk about is Bad Blood. But, like, Unusual Suspects is just a great episode of The X-Files because it taps into so much of what I find interesting, what I think is interesting sort of about The X-Files as a television show. Because it's one of the things about The Lone Gunman as compared to Mulder is that you can get away with a lot of different things with The Lone Gunman that you can't get away with Mulder. In particular, like, you can make The Lone Gunman pathetic and tragic in a way that is kind of impossible to do with Mulder at this point, because Mulder has, like, the cigarette-smoking man as an enemy. He has a conspiracy to topple. Whereas The Lone Gunmen are just three nuts who somehow found themselves together and somehow found themselves grappling with these crazy conspiracies that don't tie together, make no sense, have no cohesion, and are just trying to make sense of the world in the way that, like, conspiracy theory is. Because conspiracy theory is a way of making sense of a world that is inherently chaotic and random. And I really like the Unusual Suspects sort of capture that for me.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it's got that X-Files flavour to it while having its own sort of sense of style and identity. I think what I also liked about it was how it still has its own protagonist. You know, both in this and in Three of a Kind, which is the season six sequel episode, if you like, the protagonist is Byers. You know, and it's really interesting how Vince Gilligan decides to sort of frame this origin story for the Lone Gunman through the straight man, which, and I suppose it makes sense, really. Byers is, of the three of them, he is the one that you can play a dramatic beat through in this term. You can't really do it with Rohickey or Langley, because they are in different ways comic relief in that sense. Byers was always the straight man. He was always the dead, more of the deadpan one in his own way. So to actually play this story of him and Suzanne Modesky and you know, trying to be the hero and failing, basically, I think is a lovely way into this story, and a lovely way of actually bringing these three disparate kind of, you know, geeks and conspiracy theorists together.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of people sort of... The Lone Gunmen are generally considered to be comic relief, and they're used very well in that regard at various points of the season, but or the series. But one of the things that really strikes me and sort of sticks with me about the Lone Gunmen, and it's something that I think carries over to the spin-off that they eventually get, is the Lone Gunmen are vaguely comic, but they're vaguely comic in a way that is profoundly sad. Like, I think you could make an argument that, for example, the X-Files is rooted in, like, 70s paranoia, like Watergate, the Pentagon Papers, Vietnam, all these sort of shadows that were cast, this idea of not trusting the government. Think about the Lone Gunman, and it's a very subtle distinction, but I think that Gilligan makes it here and then sort of carries on with it through Three of a Kind and obviously into Lone Gunman Show, is that the Lone Gunmen are almost like the child of the lost 60s. Like, it's you find out that Byers' first name is John Fitzgerald Byers. Obviously, after JFK, the Lone Gunmen are named for the bullet that killed, you know, the gunman who supposedly killed Kennedy. Later on, you find they drive a beat-up sort of Volkswagen van. And, like, there's this sense that these guys genuinely believe that they might be able to make the world a better place. They're all vaguely countercultural rebels in their own little way, but in this pathetic way that's sort of doomed to failure. And there's something very affecting about, like, Byers at the... When Byers is in prison at the end, and basically Langley and Frohickey point out that, like, Suzanne Modesky's the one who got them into this situation, and, you know, isn't Byers happy? You know, is Byers sort of, is he disillusioned now because she led him down the garden path and end up here? And Byers sort of in that moment, like, it's a beautiful moment because Byers basically decides, like, in that moment that he's not going to be the guy who was led down the garden path by Suzanne Modesky, who was sort of tricked into helping out and who paid the horrible consequences for that. He was instead going to decide that he was always in it for the truth. He always wanted to expose the lies and to protect the people. And what you get the sense watching, what he really wants is he really wants, like, a life. He really wants a life with Suzanne. He really wants, like, somebody he can come back to, somebody he can love, somebody, like, we'll talk a bit about, like, I might be covering Three of a Kind later on, but, like, the opening scene of Three of a Kind where Byers imagines a world where he's living with Suzanne and he has a child. Like, that's really, really sad. The fact that he lost that and that living with the other two is like his compensation prize. Like, they're like a weird surrogate family. And it's very affecting, very touching, but it's also very sad.
Yeah, it's true, actually. And the surrogate family thing, I think, hits the nail on the head. And you kind of haven't really contextualized the gunman in that sense before this episode. They've been that kind of little trio of, you know, conspiracy theorists, all a little bit different from each other in many ways, bickering, you know, like three dysfunctional brothers almost. And they've always just been that sort of foil for Mulder's quest or whatever, or coming up with this information. So to do this kind of episode where you see more of a dramatic weight behind how they come together, I think is really good.
And later on, you do sort of see them hammering this family theme. Like, so for example, in Killswitch later in the season, the three gunmen all share the same bed, which is incredibly cute. And then in Dreamland Part 2, like, the Mulder arrives while I think Frohickey's cooking breakfast wearing an apron. Like, there is this sense that they are a family unit and that like they're only together because of this random circumstance, this thing that happened to them that could have happened to anybody else that brought them together. And I like this idea of they're trying to make sense of a world that is chaotic and uncertain. And I think it plays into this idea in the fifth season, like with Redux and with Mulder's sort of doubt and skepticism, which is an idea that isn't necessarily developed as well as it could be. But this idea that maybe the mythology at the heart of the X-Files doesn't really make sense, and maybe it's just a way of imposing order on a world that is cruel and meaningless and vindictive and full of random things that happen that upset the course of the way life was meant to go. And you try and make sense of it by imagining that there's aliens and mind control stuff. Like, I mean, do you want to talk about the origin of the X-Files in this episode? Because it's really a very subversive...
Well, I was going to mention this because it's really interesting way that Gilligan spins all this on its head, in the sense that this is obviously set in 1989. At this point, Mulder is in violent crimes and he's, you know, he's been to Oxford and everything like that. And yes, okay, he's had the experience of losing Samantha at a young age and, you know, the regression hypnotherapy and all this kind of thing. But the
he hasn't yet.
Well, no, he did as a kid, didn't he? As a kid, didn't he have a little bit of it as a kid?
I don't know, but the big one, the one from Conduit, Gilligan very, very cleverly and very subversively and very cheekily, I would argue, makes a point to consciously date Unusual Suspects, I think, several weeks before the big hypnotherapy session where he finally acknowledges that she was taken by aliens. And he also sort of seeds this idea of, you know, the bit at the start where he's like, they're coming, they're here, with the bit where Mulder picks up the alien detector at the expo. So this sort of idea of, like, is Mulder's entire life quest a result of getting, like, gassed in a sort of a warehouse in Baltimore?
And that's fascinating, because it's one of those wonderful X-Files things that is genuinely ambiguous, and it could actually be that Mulder's just been kind of under the, you know, under the spell of a mind altering compound all these years that has twisted and made him, you know, more paranoid. And and they've been playing with that idea for a while, actually. You know, Demons was not so long ago, where they play with the idea of Mulder's paranoia and is he seeing things that aren't there? Did things actually happen? Paper Hearts, where the whole, you know, down the rabbit hole with John Lee Roach. They've kind of played with this idea of what's real. What is real in Mulder's, you know, line of vision? What is real in terms of his history?
And then you get to Gethsemane, for example, which really just hammers it home.
Absolutely. So it's funny the way they keep playing with this theme as they go on, really.
Even in the third season, you have like three different X-Files origins, which are not mutually exclusive, but require a bit of massaging. Like, there's three different origin stories. There's this one, there's the one you get in Travelers, which is like Mulder found the cases by, you know, doing the case. And then you get the one in the end where it's like, oh no, he found it with Diane Fowley. It's like, all of these things can be true, but there's a sense that maybe they're independently true, or maybe you have to decide which one's true, or maybe they're all false. I really like that ambiguity in the fifth season as a whole.
Yeah, it is, and it is definitely there in this, as is Mr. X in a great little revisionist kind of cameo. Obviously, he's dead in the present day by now, but we see him come into contact and with Mulder years before he even met like Deep Throat and all this kind of things, before he became embroiled in the conspiracy. And it's a great little Stephen Williams cameo where he's really quite chilling and deadly. There's that great sequence where he drives past in the car and the window just raises up as he drives away in slow motion. Like, it's just, oh, it's great. It's a really good visual.
Well, there's even the mock execution where Byers is like, what gives you the authority? And then X proceeds to demonstrate what gives him the authority by putting the gun to his head and pulling the trigger. Like, it's just a really great scene. And I mean, we talk about, like, again, this is a very broad episode, but there are absolutely chilling bits in it. Like, during the shootout at the warehouse, the bit where the bags arrive, and the guy who's been shot with the machine gun on the ground is muttering, I'm still alive, I'm still alive. And they're sealing him up inside a little plastic bag and dragging him off in a body bag.
It's pretty terrifying. And it's one of those skillful Vince Gilligan scripts that manages to sort of, you know, cover all these different kind of styles, whether it's comedy, whether it's, you know, black comedy, whether it's quite chilling conspiracy. It's all there in this package. So it's a great little concoction. The last thing, of course, to mention is how Unusual Suspects ties the X-Files into the grand unifying John Munch theory. With an appearance by Richard Belzer from Homicide: Life on the Streets. Because obviously there's the great theory that all these universes are interconnected, largely through John Munch, who has appeared, this detective, on a half a dozen different shows. Arrested Development.
Saint Elsewhere, for example, he appeared briefly at the end of The Wire, which is kind of fun to imagine, like, the grounded world of The Wire unfolding in the same universe where Fox Mulder is investigating all this.
Yeah, I just love the idea that the X-Files and Arrested Development are in the same world, and that there could genuinely be an episode where Mulder and Scully have to investigate the Bluth family. That, I would pay money to see. That would be the greatest comedy crossover they could ever do. It would be wonderful.
Worth noting that this is sort of Gilligan's first real experiment with sort of postmodern sort of genre bending stuff. So he gets on, like, later in the season, he obviously does Bad Blood. He wanted to do a crossover with Unsolved Mysteries. Drive opens with the car chase footage, and obviously X-Cops is filmed like an episode of Cops. Like, there's a sense that Gilligan loves television, which we'll probably come back to at some point over the course of this podcast experiment, but like, I really like that touch.
It's great. Oh, if only they'd done the Unsolved Mysteries. I've been rewatching them recently on Amazon. I used to love the old Robert Stack Unsolved Mysteries. Oh, that would have been amazing. But there you go.
His narration was so good.
It was. Welcome to Unsolved Mysteries. He's great. Yeah, anyway, Unusual Suspects, quality X-File. Really good way to continue this starting season 5. Next up, then, we've got Detour, which is another really good one. You know, season 5 does start with a collection of strong, you know, interesting episodes. This one, obviously, is more intentionally comedic. This is a script by Frank Spotnitz, directed by Brett Dowler, who's not a concurrent well-known X-Files director, but he does a good job with this. And this obviously pitches Mulder and Scully investigating disappearances in the Everglades forest. And they potentially come across, well, a monster and possibly like the Fountain of Youth and all kinds of stuff like that. The thing with Detour is that, a bit like Quagmire in the third season, it's very well known and very well loved among many people for its specific Mulder and Scully shippy moments. But I think that it's just, that's sort of doing it a disservice in a way, because I think Detour's got more going on.
It really does, but I feel like we have to acknowledge that. I'm like, for me, Detour is the moment at which Mulder and Scully are unequivocally hooking up. Like, it's the point where Scully brings wine and cheese to his room. When Scully is packing her bags, you'll notice that while Mulder runs to her room to check where she is, she's packing her bags in his room at the very end.
Yeah.
But it's the moment, like, you can get a sense that, like, during the fifth season, the writers were like, look, a large part of what appeals about the show is the Mulder Scully relationship. And you have, like, obviously you had, like, Catatoni at the same time was releasing there. You know, things are getting stranger, starting to worry. This could be a case for Mulder
and
Scully.
Which
is great, in a Welsh accent, which got to number 3 in the charts. But, like, there's a sense going into the feature film that the writers understood that this was as much an appeal to the audience as the mythology itself. And I really, really like it. And for me, if you know, I'm shipping agnostic, but as far as I'm concerned, when I watch Detour, there is absolutely no way that Mulder and Scully are a conventional platonic male-female friendship at this point. I don't think they're a conventional relationship either, but I think there's no way in which they are not, you know, involved in some way. But I think you're right. Detour is also just great all round. Like, it's a really great X-Files, you know? It's a sort of like, it's got this wonderful sort of theme of wilderness, which sort of plays out across the X-Files, going back to, like, Darkness Falls. This idea of America as an untamed wilderness, which is full of things at the heart of the country that may swallow people up and devour them. It's not even like, we talk about, like, the forest episodes like Darkness Falls, but even the basic idea of the show is Mulder and Scully go to a weird place every week and discover this sort of hidden aspect of American folklore. Detour just makes that more explicit by saying, and there's this really great scene at the start where they're like, the trees in this forest are older than the country itself, and the idea that the conquistadors who came to the country have somehow discovered the Fountain of Youth and are haunting the forests. And it's this really beautiful, very evocative story about how, like, the countryside is more alien and more hostile perhaps than people really think that it is. It's just got this beautiful sort of eerie atmosphere that uses Vancouver spectacularly well, even doubling as Florida.
Yeah, it does. You wouldn't think they were in Vancouver. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe better than they've done before in terms of this. I think what sticks with me with Detour is there are various different elements. It's visuals like the, you know, the glowing red eyes of the creature, you know, staring at the boy and things like that. Mark Snow's great score throughout this, and luckily on the recent, I think it was Volume 3 or Volume 4. Music release, you get quite a bit of Detour, and it's, some of the music is tremendous. He really gets this sort of rippling kind of chill down your spine effect of something, you know, lurking in the woodland. It's hard to explain, but it's really good. And,
well, I mean, even the intro features the forest bleeding.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Obviously, you discover later on that he's obviously stuck the device through one of these camouflage people. But it looks like the forest is bleeding, which is this beautiful sort of evocative image of what, like, this environmentalist idea of what they're doing to the forest. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. And then you've got the whole subtextual, you know, layer in the writing of the whole FBI partnership thing, you know, with the character of Stone Cipher and her partner, Agent Kinsley. And they're just like, they're a really earnest FBI agent, you know, duo, who they go into this conference with Mulder and Scully, and there's just some great deadpan, like, David Duchovny moments, you know, where he just turns to Scully and goes, kill me now, and things like that.
My favourite aspect of that particular subplot is the way that it pays off, which is Mulder and Scully go off wandering into the wilderness alone, you know, with a bunch of extras together, single-handedly, and get surrounded and trapped and sort of end up in a cave, whereas Stone Cipher and the other guy end up, they do it properly. They send out search parties, yeah, and they coordinate, and they actually put their teamwork into practice, and they end up saving Mulder and Scully at the end. Like, it's an ending that, if it wasn't so funny and hilarious, would seem like sort of Deus Ex Machina,
yeah,
ending. But it works very well because it's basically like, ha, Mulder's kind of a little bit wrong here when he jokes about teamwork not being important.
It's true. Yeah, that's absolutely right. He learns that lesson, really, doesn't he, in a way? Or at least that...
No, he doesn't learn that lesson.
That lesson is there, but he doesn't really, yeah, he doesn't really learn it. But that lesson is certainly there. But it's the spell when they're lost in the forest, really, or they're trapped in the forest, and, you know, Mulder's...
Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
That's the moment. That's the moment everyone just loves. And that's that scene where, you know, he's freezing and she just holds him, and there's that lovely little interplay. And I think the show was getting more confident in doing this now, you know, certainly over the last season, and from season 5 onwards into season 6, it happens all the time. But you get the show pausing to have these moments between them. And, you know, some people might say, oh, well, that's the point where the show starts to lose the element that made it great, a really scary, exciting, you know, show in the first place. But I don't think so. I think it adds to just the love of those characters. And Detour would have been good anyway, but I think having those elements in it is what makes it stand out as a really, really enjoyable, fun episode of the show.
It really is. It's an absolute pleasure to revisit. And I mean, like, a lot of the fifth season is like that, where obviously you have the big world beater episodes. Like, obviously you've got, like, Bad Blood, we've mentioned a couple of times on this podcast. But I mean, even at the start of the season, like, episodes like this and some of the other ones that we might be talking about, they're very, very, very good. Even if they're not, like, top 10 or top 20 episodes. It's just, it's really firing on all cylinders. I think maybe the middle of the season, maybe towards the tail end, drips a bit. But I think coming out of the gate, like, you couldn't ask for a stronger sort of two monsters of the week than the two we've gotten. And there's some great stuff coming up.
Definitely. Absolutely. And it's coming up very soon, because we're going to be back for the next double episode of the Podwatch, in which we'll be talking about the postmodern Prometheus and Christmas Carol, the first of the two-part mythology story. So we're gonna be back very soon for more pod watching. Until we are, Darren, where can people find you?
You can find me online on Twitter at Darren_Mooney. You can find me at the Movie Blog with a 0 instead of an O in the first case. You can find me, I'm on the 250 hosting a podcast on your Black Hole Media Network, yes, which is very, very cool. Yeah, basically wherever good podcasts are sold. Oh, I also have a book coming out as well, maybe. I should probably mention, which is available where all good books are sold. Cheers.
Yeah, cool, thank you. And you can follow me at AJ Black Writer on Twitter, and obviously the XCast is at the X_cast on Twitter, and check out our Facebook page and group as well, which hopefully you already do. But enough of this, we're going to let you take off and get ready to watch the next two episodes before we return tomorrow. So until then, remember, as always, trust no one.